Welcome to Striving, the podcast for the modern spiritual seeker. My name is Sean Andrich. Today I am joined for the first time by my lovely wife, Carla.
I always get to be lovely when you introduce me. It's nice.
It's also true. So this week we want to talk about something that's very relevant for our relationship and our lives, which is depression. It's been something this time of year that seems to come up more as the days get shorter. It gets cold. You kind of start drawing inward to stay warm, and almost without fail, you start, at least I start, drawing more inward in general in my own life and my own mind and stuff. So there's been a lot of people on the internet talking about depression, dealing with it ongoing, worried about having relapses, stuff like that. So I wanted to have Carla on because you've dealt with depression for years now. And that's been something that's been, you know, almost sight unseen at times, not even recognized at times. It's been a major part of some of the difficulties we've had in our relationship, like any relationship has. So I kind of wanted to just go through the progression of when you first started experiencing it and what that was like, and we'll kind of work through that stuff as best we can here.
That's a difficult sort of question to ask, because you can look back. Hindsight is 20/20, right? I can look back on my life and think about various stages or periods in my life where I was having difficulties in school or with my family, and looking back at it now, that looks like depression to me. But I mean, I wasn't seeing anybody at the time about it. You can't really know. So for me, depression has been something that has kind of slowly gathered force, like a snowball rolling downhill in my life. I would say I was probably prone to it even back in high school, but it wasn't until I got to be an adult and faced bigger challenges that it turned into something that really started affecting my life.
Sure. And you know, we talked about this in the past. There was probably a point about a year or two into our relationship where you went through what we recognize now as your first sort of real
depressive episode.
Yeah. What you'd call like something that lasted for more than a few days. I mean, when prior to all this, when I would think of depression, it was more of an Eeyore kind of thing. It was something that it lasts for a day or two or three, and you're depressed. It means you're sad. It means you don't, it means you're not happy about things. It means you have a negative outlook.
But right, you're sitting on your floor crying kind
yeah,
of thing.
That was kind of the thing. But really, you know, from the outside looking in, that doesn't seem to be what actual depression is.
No, for me anyway, depression, it's more like a flattening out of all my feelings, what they call flat affect, where you just don't really react to things. Well, let's get into the personal pronouns here. I don't really react to things. Mm. I go into my own head. It's very difficult for me to look outward, and it's an incredibly self-centered way to exist, which can be tough for the person who has to live with you.
Yeah, when you're in a relationship and one of the people is very, very, I would call it self-centered in a way, but not in a, not in that arrogant way that we normally ascribe self-centeredness to. But
right.
And I've always been very self-interested in my own way too. So between when you're, we'll kind of stay on the timeline a little bit
sure.
here. So you went through that first bout, and even when we finally, and I say we because it really was kind of a team effort in a way, even when you finally came out of that, we didn't label it as depression. It wasn't at the time really in our lexicon.
No, I don't think either of us were interested in labeling it anything about it at all. We just wanted to put it behind us and forget.
and you know, I mean, in my experience, it was that really rough couple months where we didn't have sex much. Was you know, because we was young, early in the relationship, and it's true, right? Like, I mean, part of the how that manifested was we didn't necessarily have sex a lot, and we weren't close
Yeah, we didn't talk much either.
Yeah.
You were working from home at the time. I believe you had your own business. And I would go to the school every day and then come home and we would eat and then just...
Well, we just exist together. I mean, we've always gotten along, you know, and we've always had similar interests. So it's been easy to hang out and be easy with each other.
And even that went away during that period.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember a lot of specifics at this point. That might be on purpose. I'm not sure. But that was kind of the first time we really encountered something like that. And it wasn't until years later, we'd since moved into our own house and, you know, I'd started my own career path and you were working at home on your own home business and stuff like that. It wasn't until, you know, years later when it became something that wasn't going away, you know, although this time it was a little bit different because even though, you know, and we'll talk about sort of what that growing feeling of depression was, just from where I was standing from the outside looking in on it, you know, the sex life was still pretty regular and, you know, you were pleased to see me when I got home and things seemed kind of okay, but that wasn't really what was going on.
Well, and it actually wasn't that long after we moved into this house. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. My best friend was actually going through kind of the same sort of thing that I was, and she had started taking antidepressants, and she had, you know, come to terms with the fact that she was dealing with depression. And I remember saying to you at one point, you know, I think I might be depressed. And your reaction was, you sort of didn't want to hear it. And I can understand why. I mean, it's not easy to look at, and it's kind of frightening in its implications.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I really hated labels, and to a point I do now, but a lot less so. So when you would come to me and say, I think I may be depressed, you know, to my mind that was like, oh God, if you think that maybe you're depressed, then now you're a depressed person. So of course you're going to be depressed because that's what you've just said you are. And now you're identifying with it. Don't.
Such bullshit.
Don't identify with it. You know, like just anything to keep the...
Right. And I mean, that's not a personal failing of yours. That's society. It's getting better, but people still have a lot of hang-ups and incorrect associations that go along with mental illness. Depression being a mental illness, and there's nothing, I mean, it doesn't mean that you're crazy. Having a mental illness is no different than having a physical illness. You know, it's just something that happens, and you need to find a way to live your life in such a way that it doesn't incapacitate you.
Right. And you know, and I've talked in prior shows recently about relying on other people and stuff, but at that point in my life years ago, I was so, you know, I was so self-reliant and so used to that sort of mode, I just sort of wanted to see everybody around me be the same way. So, and so it became, we were kind of at an impasse with it, and we didn't really talk about it all that much at all after that, from what I remember, but it did get progressively worse for you.
Yeah.
So
I was trying as hard as I possibly could to pretend that it wasn't there, which never works, by the way. and I was spending large portions of my day by myself. You know, I only had myself to motivate myself to do anything. Also a pitfall of being self-employed and home alone with your business. There's no boss to poke you in the back. And it did get to the point where I was sitting on the floor of the kitchen crying pretty much every day.
Yeah. And, you know, it's tough to hear from someone you love after the fact that, you know, she's been going through this kind of depression where she would be, where you'd be, you know, crying on the floor. You talk about sitting on a chair and just staring at the wall for it sounded like hours at a time.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And it's hard. I can't even, there's no empathy in me for that specifically. I've never had a moment where I would, my brain, like where things would just sort of shut down and go neutral like that. Like, it's not that you hate the world or don't love the people you're with or anything else. It's just flat.
Yeah. It's brain chemistry is what it is. And it took me a really long time to stop blaming myself for it.
So this went on for months in a way. Like, how long do you think this, before you decided to go and you know, find someone to talk to about it who wasn't me? Because obviously I didn't have the tools.
Right.
To, you know, and that's, you know, that's something that I'm still, you know, feel guilt about. But it got to a point where you did reach out and you did go for help and you did start taking steps. How long would you say that it lasted before you got to that point?
The real tough period, the rock bottom, mm-hmm. as it were, probably about 3 months.
Yeah.
My capacity for suffering is large.
Yeah.
I think that I just reached a point where I just wasn't willing to go on like this anymore. And the other options, as it were, weren't options. So I needed help.
Right. And just to be clear, we're talking about suicide here.
Yeah. Self-harm.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Just anything to, anything to get... you hear that often, it's the cliches, the teenager who's cutting themselves so that they can feel, it's always talked about in sort of a...
Well, you say it like that, but that's exactly why people do it.
Well, yeah, and it's just, it's an unfortunate thing because it really is kind of a cry for help in that situation, but you weren't doing that anyway.
No, I mean, I wasn't cutting myself, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't doing drugs. All of which are things that people do mm-hmm. to try and self-medicate.
Yeah, and now when you're in a relationship, and in this case, I'm the spouse who's not depressed, and I've obviously got my own stuff going on, but what really, it was hard for me in the sense that I wasn't the person who was suffering, so I was always putting your needs ahead of mine, and I was kind of forever trying to figure out, like when I would come home sometimes it'd be, 5 p.m. and you'd be laying in bed, not because you're sick, physically ill, just because you're tired or you didn't sleep or whatever reason you'd given me at the time, right?
Whatever.
Yeah,
excuse I was trying to.
Right, and you'd come into things, situations like that, and all I wanted to do was just kind of be with you and hold you and talk about it and da 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 da, and it was just kind of this ongoing cycle. I never truly understood the depth of the suffering. Because a lot of it happened when I wasn't here.
Well, and a lot of it, most of the time, I was trying to hide it from you.
Yeah, and so you'd put on a great show when I'd come home, and I would look at it like, oh, okay, well, Carl's having a good day, that's great. But in the back of my mind, it's like you said, in hindsight, in retrospect, you're a lot smarter and wiser and more intelligent looking back on things. In the back of my mind, I knew there was something wrong. But I didn't, I didn't ask the right questions. I never pushed. I always thought, don't try and fix her. Don't push her to do anything she doesn't want to do. Just be with her and be there for her, and she'll figure it out. Now, to your credit, you did figure it out. But part, I think, of what maybe prolonged it was that I wasn't willing to have the uncomfortable conversation with you.
Yeah.
And I wasn't willing to tell you that I had needs, not speaking sexually here, but I had needs that weren't being met anymore by you because you were so, self-involved. And of course, I was, again, still Mr. Self-Reliant. And I think part of that was just protecting myself from that, because you're so raw and emotional, and you'd have crying jags, or, you know, it became something that was really hard for me personally to engage with, because it was just overwhelming. I had enough trouble being emotional in the first place. So that's kind of some of the relationship stuff. And, you know, it came to a point where you reached out for help. And so what was that process like when you decided you'd had enough?
Well, I had previously gone to a therapist exactly one time. she and I didn't click. This is a few years back when my parents were splitting up, and that was really difficult on me. She and I didn't click, and I never went back. But I'd had all that experience of trying to find somebody in the first place. And I think at that point, too, I just wasn't ready for therapy, because you need to be ready before you go.
No.
So I just kind of went online and found a list of people who specialized in depression, which is not difficult to find. And I just took a list of the people who were nearest us, nearest our house, because we have one car and it's difficult for me to get anywhere that's not directly on the bus lines. And I just really lucked out. The first person I went to see, she and I just really clicked immediately, and it worked out. But I really have to stress that if you don't click with the first person, do not give up. And don't feel bad about leaving your therapist either, because they are very used to that. That was one of the first things that she said to me when we sat down. She's like, I may not be the right therapist for you. Mm-hmm. These first few sessions are about trying to find out whether I am. So if you don't think that I am, I will be fine if you leave and find somebody else.
And any good therapist should lay that out for you ahead of time.
Immediately.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's a long-term relationship, and it's a very personal, private, vulnerable, scary, deep, painful, angry relationship.
And if you can't, if there's anything standing in the way of you building that trust, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. So that was one part of it, which was, you know, talking to somebody and starting to work through things. And then the other part of it was something that at the time I had a lot of trouble accepting, or, you know, I wanted you to not be suffering anymore. So I was willing to see anything through. But when you said that you felt like you went to talk to your doctor and you decided to go on to medication, that was another part of this process for you.
Yeah. And I was fairly resistant to it at the first as well. I think that a lot of people have this image in their heads about what antidepressants are. They think about lithium and the stuff that people were taking back in the 70s, which could be very personality affecting and could flatten you right out and change the person that you were day to day. But that was 40 years ago. There have been advances in science. I don't know if people are aware of this. And the kind of medications and the kind of doses that they start you on are very, very different, which is not to say that they don't still have side effects. They do. And my adjustment to it was a month-long process.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of tough on me.
It was. I mean, you had things like dizziness.
So dizzy that I couldn't actually walk down the stairs a couple days.
Yeah. And, you know, dizziness, and your appetite was just gone.
It took me probably 4 to 5 months before my appetite returned, like for food. Return to anything nearing normal. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that my relationship with food altered permanently during that period of time.
Right, because when you don't enjoy the process of eating food anymore, then all of a sudden it's like you talked to me about it before, it's not a comfort thing anymore. There's no comfort to comfort eating.
No.
It's a mechanical process. You know?
I actually went online for help. And a lot of the tricks that they use for feeding people who are on chemo and have lost their appetite completely worked for me. So,
mm-hmm. So what exactly is this medication called?
It's a citalopram, the I guess the brand name would be Celexa.
Mm-hmm. And what does that actually do chemically as far as, do you understand, do you have a sense of what
yeah,
it does?
Yeah, it's a serotonin anti-uptake something something. Basically what it means is that there are, and I'm going to break this down as laymanly as possible, there are parts of your brain that release happy chemicals, and there's other parts that pick them up again so that you don't get too happy. What the drug does for me is that it prevents my brain from picking up the happy chemicals quite as often. Mm-hmm. So there's more of them floating around in my head.
that's basically it. So once you got past, you know, the side effects, and at this point you've been on it, I want to say it's been a couple years.
Yeah, it'll be 2 years in February, I think.
Yeah, and you know, and so at this point, are there any lingering side effects from it that you're aware of?
It's hard to tell. One of the side effects listed that affected me pretty strongly in the beginning was that I would grind my teeth, clench my jaw, like intermittently throughout the day. I'd realize that I was suddenly clenching my jaw quite hard, to the point where I had the muscles on the sides of my face grew sore.
Yeah.
I've been waking up in the morning every now and then and feeling like a little tense around that area, like I might have been doing it at night, but I mean, lots of people grind their teeth at night. It's kind of hard to tell at this point whether that's because of the citalopram or not.
Right. And so other than that, no real, you know, you haven't grown horns, you haven't.
No.
And I think that, you know,
I have on the very rare occasion have what's called lucid dreaming, where you have extremely vivid, in color, linear dreams that you can at times control. Like you realize you're dreaming and you can direct the dream. Those are fun as hell.
I do that too. You don't even need drugs for that. Actually, since I cut caffeine off, I've had more of those, which is weird. I think that the important thing I want to get across as your husband, you know, and to people who are maybe looking at medications like this, my greatest fear was losing you, you know, the woman I married, the woman I love, the personality I get along with, all those, that great stuff. And the fact is you're still you completely, and you're just you, but happier. And it's not, I don't believe, I think the medication's only 10-20% of it. I think that, you know, one of the reasons I think more open to the idea of medication, not that it was really my decision anyway, was that you'd been in therapy for a while already at that point. So you were, to
6 months.
So to my self-reliant head, you were already, quote, doing the work. Right. You were you were already digging into the problem and, you know, working through stuff. And I could already see results from that. And it was like, OK, this is good, but I'm still, you know, like there was still something that you needed help with. And what this has done is it gave you another leg up so that you could keep going forward. And at this point, it just sort of, you know, let's talk about now maintaining, because You've still had times, right, where the depression has flared up again.
Yep. That's another thing about medication. It's not a fix-all, mm-hmm. not by a long shot. And if you rely on it for that, you are going to get depressed again. I think that the one really big bad patch that I've had since I've started working on all my issues came from the fact that I wanted really badly to believe that I had won.
Yeah,
you know?
and so did I, because we, you know, we went back to that, and it was like maybe a 2 month span, give or take, something like that.
Yeah. And it's tempting to think that way once you get to a point where you have your life kind of back on track again and things are working. And I had actually spoken to my GP about possibly going off the medication. And then life kind of spiraled out of control again.
Mm-hmm.
And a large part of that was because I didn't want to see the warning signs that were happening. My lack of motivation, not wanting to get up in the morning the way I used to, letting exercise fall by the wayside because I didn't feel motivated enough to do it. You know, all the day-to-day work that is what really makes things better. I had started to let that slip because I didn't want to believe that I needed it anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's not unlike alcoholism or anything else that people, it's just there's, it's not like there's ever going to come a point in your life, you know, where you're just not a depressive person anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a diabetic getting a 6-week run of good blood sugar and saying, oh, well, I guess I don't need insulin anymore.
I'm cured. Yeah. And for my part, I so wanted you to be past it as well that I ignored the warning signs that were available to me. And I didn't ask the right questions. So some of the things we do now, since we went through that relapse, one of the things we did is we went to couples therapy to talk about how we communicate.
Yeah.
And you know, not just about your depression, but just in general. Most of the sessions have been purely focused on how we communicate, mm-hmm. you know, because we wanted to get tools so that we could be more, you know, honest about both our feelings, our needs, specifically my needs a lot of the time, and being able to communicate all that stuff. So these days, you know, when I come home, the first thing we do is we ask each other about the day, and not just how's your day? It was fine. Oh, that's good. It's how was your experience today? You know, and we talk through things that happened, how we feel. We were honest about what we did or didn't do or what we'd wanted to do but couldn't or whatever else. And it just, you know, we rely on each other to keep each other honest, you know, and to ask those questions so it doesn't get to that crisis point again is kind of the idea.
Well, and it's also about getting past shame, which has been a huge operative force in my depression, both in why I'm depressed and also in my difficulties in asking for help and in letting you know what was going on with me. So
now things are pretty good. And now we want to just keep working to, you know, the ups and downs are going to come.
Yeah.
You know?
And I mean, I don't feel like I ever want to rest on my laurels again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't even like saying things are pretty good. I would, the way I think about it is like we are working hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that something we're both coming to together, which has been really nice, is that, you know, we are both worth the effort of being happy, and we both deserve each other, and we deserve to help each other, and we deserve to be helped, and we can be happy without a bunch of negative stuff chasing along behind it to kind of maintain some weird balance that doesn't even exist anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and
I mean, I really like where we've come to. I'm happy and proud of the work I've done in the past few years, trying to get my brain together. I still don't know that I would say that I'm glad that I am depressed. It's hard to ever really feel that something that terrible is something that had to happen for you to become a whole and happy person.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and you don't need to be a, you know, a clinically, you know, chemically depressed person you don't need to experience those extreme lows before you can reach out for help, before you can, you know.
And I don't like the idea of putting my illness on a pedestal, mm-hmm. and saying, look at all the good things that came from me being so fucking miserable.
Yeah, it was truly awful.
Yeah, you don't need to suffer as long as I did. You really don't.
Yeah, so if you need something from, you know, your partner, your friends, your family that you're not getting, speak up. because you'll be shocked, I think, at how quickly and how happily they'll respond to your needs. And
or you know, find somebody to ask that doesn't have all the baggage attached to them. I mean, that's basically what a therapist is.
Yeah.
It's somebody that you don't need to worry about. You can unload all your crap and they don't have any stake, basically.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So there you go. That's Depression 101 with Carla. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're very welcome.
This has been Stravin. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. If you want to join the discussion, visit strivingpodcast.com or email reach@strivingpodcast.com.